Thank you, Brother Josh, for causing us to ponder the testimony of God and our testimony. For in case there's anyone here that didn't hear, the month of August has three specific testimonies of God that we shouldn't miss. This Wednesday, there's going to be two of them. One is a solar eclipse, which is just going to be a very small sliver on the sun. I don't know how easy to be able to see it even, and you need to be careful when you look at the sun, but the moon will pass across the very edge. And I understand there's meteor showers, and the 12th, which is this Wednesday night, is going to be one of the best sightings. And what's exciting about this one is that it's new moon, and so the sky should be fairly dark. And so if you want to see some of the testimony of God, lay out in the yard after dark. And then I forget the date. Is it the 28th? There's going to be a lunar eclipse. And that will be all but a little bit of the sliver of the moon will be shining for a time. So, God's testimony has different ways of catching our attention and reminding us of His holiness. I find it awesome to think of meteor showers and these coming into the atmosphere and burning up. I mean, God knows what He's doing. I mean, how many of those could have just come to the earth and destroyed the earth? But meteors fly through the sky, into the atmosphere at amazing rates and burn up. I would like to, over the next couple of months, preach a series of messages, and they will be specifically on lifestyle choices. And so I would like to touch on a number of different areas, money, clothing, technology, Sunday, numerous things, and I would open myself up to you that if you have any specific suggestion on a lifestyle choice that should be addressed, I would welcome you to let me know that. I am going to title this series, Use This World, Not Abusing It. And we can find that in 1 Corinthians 7. We're going to turn there and read a couple of verses in 1 Corinthians 7. This wording in the King James has always intrigued me. Using this world, but not abusing it. I think that's a very interesting way to put it. And the Apostle Paul is writing to the Corinthians here. There was a time of persecution. Things were difficult. And Paul was calling them to bring their focus back to the things that really matter. We have the whole thing of marriage here and encouraging that if you're single, it would probably be good if you remain single. You could be the most effective that way. And down in verse 29, he says, "But this I say, brethren, the time is short. It remaineth that both they that have wives be as though they have none, and they that weep as though they wept not, and they that rejoice as though they rejoice not, and they that buy as though they possess not, and they that use this world as not abusing it, for the fashion of the world passes away." This word abusing simply means to misuse or overuse. So we are in the world. We know Jesus said that He's not going to take us out of the world, but that God would protect us while we're in the world, we're in the world, but we're not of the world. And there's plenty of things that we need to involve ourselves in. We use the things of this world. But the challenge is for us is to use them in an ethical way that doesn't misuse or overuse them. Another translation put it this way, do not get attached to the things of this world. And I thought that's kind of a weak rendering, but simply is saying that we're part of this world and we're going to be using this world, but we're not to be get attached to the world. But I really like this word abusing. We're not to misuse or overuse. And so today, my title is Use But Not Abuse, and then however you want to do it, / money. Use but not abuse money. As we continue, consider using and not abusing, before we get into money, the great albatross flies around the world several times in the course of its life. These birds can stand being buffeted by the ocean gales for days, but they become seasick if they stand on the deck of a moving ship. I understand these big birds will follow ships through the ocean, and when they throw things out, they kind of follow them for that reason. And some of them have been brave enough to actually on these big ships to come in and land. And these birds don't do well on a ship. And can you imagine? They fly through the air, and they can take all kinds of wind currents. But as soon as their feet are planted on a ship, they become seasick. Christians can face buffeting by life so long as they remember that they're in the world, but not of the world. When they become part of the world, they lose their Christian joy and power because they're out of the element for which God created them. Another person said, he who marries the spirit of the age today will be a widower tomorrow. He who marries the spirit of the age today will be a widower tomorrow. John Wesley put it this way, whatever weakens your reason, impairs the tenderness of your conscience, obscures your sense of God, or takes off the relish of spiritual things. Whatever increases the authority of your body over your mind, that thing is sin. Using, not abusing. And so we're going to consider money. And someone said it this way, a man's treatment of money is the most decisive test of his character. How he makes it and how he spends it. And I know they say, you know, once you touch a man's pocketbook, that's when you kind of cross a line. And relationships. There's a poem that says, out of this life I shall never take things of silver and gold I make. All that I cherish and hoard away after I leave on earth must stay. Though I have toiled for a painting rare to hang on my wall, I must leave it there. Though I call it mine and boast of its worth, I must give it up when I quit the earth. All that I gather and all that I keep, I must leave behind when I fall asleep. And I often wonder what I shall own in that other life when I pass alone. What shall they find and what shall they see in the soul that answers the call for me. Shall the great judge learn when my task is through that the Spirit had gathered some riches too? It shall at the last it be mine to find. It shall at the last be mine to find that all I had worked for I'd left behind. Okay, so I am going to begin by giving four principles from the scripture. There would be plenty of other principles that we could bring out as far as money. I want to bring out four principles, and then I'm going to spend a better part of my message being real practical and talk about the things we deal with. And so, our first principle, if you're taking notes, is a giver rather than a taker. Our first principle today is a giver rather than a taker. We find that in Ephesians 4:28, it says, "Let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands the thing which is good, that he may have to give to him that needeth." And for some reason or other, as I was pondering this verse earlier this week, I thought that what it said is that we're not supposed to steal, we're supposed to labor, working with our hands, that thing which is good, that we may have and have to give to those in need. And I don't know where I got that, but that was the way I remembered this verse. But it actually doesn't even say laboring with your hands so that you may have. It's simply saying laboring with your hands so you could have to give to others. And I think it's specifically said that way because he's addressing people who are stealing. Were they actually literally stealing? Were they actually going into people's houses at night and stealing? Would have it just been something so much as they were too lazy to work and they were sponging off of other people? Or was it they were an employee for an employer, and they were taking advantage of him and stealing time from him? I don't know what he was referring to here, but he is saying, rather than being a taker, you're supposed to become a giver. And so we should be known, every one of us should be known as a giver, not a taker. Shame on us if we would have the testimony of being a taker. So let him that steal, steal no more. Rather than stealing and taking advantage of humanity, let's become addicted to, rather than stealing, addicted to giving. I thought it was interesting too, but rather let him labor. And I thought, what does that word mean? This word labor, getting it from the Strong's, simply says to feel fatigue. So it is okay to work hard, and it's okay to work hard enough that you get tired. To feel fatigue, by implication, to work hard, bestow labor, toil, be wearied. And so the whole definition has this idea of working hard enough that you get tired. As we consider money and we consider giver being a giver rather than taker, our first principle, I would like to give you 3 points that are taken from a message that John Wesley preached. And you might remember it. A number of years ago, I preached on somewhat this same subject, and I gave you 3 points that he had in his message. In his message, he had 3 points. The first point was gain all you can, and I think that's the idea of laboring, gain all you can. The first one is not safe without the next two, but labor, gain all you can. Some of his sub-points under that one, gain all you can. You should gain all you can without hurting your mind and without hurting your neighbor. And I thought that was interesting. Labor hard, gain all you can, but you know, take care of your body. Some of us don't know so well how to do that. We'll work, and there's times for that. We might put in a 16-hour day, a hard, long day. We go to bed, we're in bed for 4 hours, we're up the next morning, and we're working again. The human body can do that on spurts once in a while. And the ladies over here are all saying, that sounds like my normal life with my babies. A body can only do that so long and for so much. And so John Wesley said, gain all you can, but make sure you don't hurt your mind and don't hurt your neighbor while you're doing it. The second one, I wanted to mention also, this was not in his message, but we heard this one before. Some people spend their health to make their wealth and then spend their wealth to try to get their health back again. And so gain all you can without hurting your mind or others. Number two, save all you can. So we work hard, we make a lot of money. That's no excuse to just splatter it everywhere. His second point was save all you can. And a point under that was expend no part of it merely to gratify the flesh in catering to the pleasures of sense in whatever kind. He didn't beat around the bush. John Wesley didn't. Save all you can. And the third one is give all you can. And he said, saving for the Christian is of little value unless he's willing to give all he can for the good of humanity. Not to use it effectually, John said, is to throw it away. So gain all you can, save all you can, and give all you can. That's our first principle, giver rather than taker. Principle number two. And principle number two just may be the most important. And that principle is the future investments. And as I read that poem there at the beginning, you know, the person who wrote that was saying, you know, we're going to end up. Those things we count really special, a lot of those things are going to be left behind. And he just wondered if that perhaps when the soul answers to God, that perhaps there was something that was sent over there on that side that he will be able to enjoy in the afterlife. Future investments. Someone said, what we hoard, we lose. What we give away, we store. And my scripture verse here, I'm going to just read it to you, is in 1 Timothy 6:17 and 2:19. Charge them that are rich in this world that they be not high-minded, nor trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God, who giveth us richly all things to enjoy, that they do good, that they be rich in good works, ready to distribute, willing to communicate, laying up in store for themselves a good foundation against the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life. Now, there's a possibility that this means more than just putting investments over there in heaven. In case you don't know, the Bible is very clear that what we do as unto the Lord is laying up investments for us in the future. This could also mean, as we consider, even in this life. Turn over to Luke 16, and here's a verse that could probably be taken either way, whether it is laying up in store for themselves a good foundation against the time to come. Is that heaven? Is that even here on earth, that they may lay hold on eternal life? Luke chapter 16. And we're going to read this parable that Jesus gave. 1-9. And he said also unto his disciples, there was a certain rich man which had a steward. The same was accused unto him that he had wasted his goods. And he called him and said unto him, how is it that I hear of this of thee? Give an account of thy stewardship, for thou mayest be no longer steward. Then the steward said within himself, what shall I do? for my Lord taketh away from me the stewardship. I cannot dig, and to beg I am ashamed. I am resolved what to do, that when I am put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their houses. So he called every one of his Lord's debtors unto him, and said unto the first, How much owest thou unto my Lord? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said unto him, Take that bill, and sit down quickly, and write 50. Then said he to another, And how much owest thou? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said unto him, Take that bill, and write 80. And the Lord commended the unjust steward, because he had done wisely, for the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light. And I say unto you, make to yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when you fail, they may receive you into everlasting habitations. So what does that say? That is saying that the heathens have figured this one out better than the Christians have. The heathens have figured out that if they invest into someone's life or somehow do some good things in someone's life, that when things go bad for them, they'll be there to catch them. This man was really smart. He went and said, you know, I just might lose my job. And if I lose my job, there goes my place to live and everything. And so I'm going to take some of these people and I'm going to do them a good turn, so that just in case I lose my position, I've done them a good turn, and they will be able to do me a good turn. And the specific challenge to us is making ourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness. I think that's simply saying taking the practical things. I don't think it's talking about sinful things, the mammon of unrighteousness. I think it's just simply saying, take the practical things of life, the things we have, the things we got a hold of, the money that we have, the opportunity to do good to someone else, and let's take those things and not abuse them and misuse them or overuse them, but use them in a way that it sets for us a good future. Turn them into cash later, as it were. I believe that could even be for us today. You know, we have this verse in 2 Corinthians 8, but by an equality, that now at this time your abundance may be a supply for their want, that their abundance also may be a supply for your want, that there may be an equality, as it is written, he that hath gathered much hath nothing over, he that hath gathered little hath no lack. So it's this idea of, you know, I have something that I can take, and I can be a blessing to someone else, and maybe one day it'll turn around, and they can be a blessing to me. I don't know that there's anything necessarily has to be greedy about that. I think it's just a principle that works. I think we can be greedy about that, and our main motive would be to take care of myself. No, we care enough about our brother or our sister, we're going to do them a good turn. And praise God if one day I'm in their shoes and they can do a good turn for me. I think the other thing it does mean, as it says in Matthew 6, lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. And I'm sure we could speculate all day what this might look like and how that might be when we get over there. All we know is that we have the opportunity of laying treasures up over there. And if the other world was so real to us, but since we can't see it, we haven't experienced it, we know so little about it, it's really hard to set our mind over there. But lay up for yourself treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal. And so I guess the question to us is, are we going to let the heathen outsmart us? Children of this world are wiser than the children of light. Okay, future investments. Number three, we're talking about principles, contentment. And let's turn to 1 Timothy 6, 6 to 10. 1 Timothy 6, 6 to 10. Short but familiar verse, verse 6. But godliness with contentment is great gain. 4. Why did he say that? We brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and raiment, let us be therewith content. But they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. 4. The love of money is the root of all evil, which while some coveted after, they have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. He says here, contentment. We should be content if we have food and raiment. And I think food and raiment here is simply giving us that basic necessity. You say, well, then I don't need a house. I believe he's just describing, and didn't probably describe them all. If you have the basic necessities of life, you got food, you got clothing, you got a roof over your head from the elements, that's where contentment needs to be. Basic foods. All of us should answer this principle. Are we content? Are we content? It doesn't mean that we won't go beyond that. There's some people who, I got food, I got clothing, and so they flit away the rest of life. They might only work 25 hours a week because they don't need to work for more than that. But they have no interest in helping their neighbor and being a giver. We're not talking about that. Robinson Crusoe found himself on a deserted island. His Bible was basically the only thing he found among the rubbish of his ship that was worth anything. So he finds himself stranded on an island all by himself. All he had anymore was his Bible. This was his testimony. I learned to look more upon the bright side of my condition than upon the dark side, and to consider what I enjoy rather than what I wanted. And this gave me sometimes such secret comforts that I cannot express them, and which I take notice here to put those discontented people in mind of it, who cannot enjoy comfortably what God hath given them, because they see and covet something that he has not given them. All our discontents about what we want appear to me to spring from the want of thankfulness for what we have. And so if we're not thankful for the basic necessities of life and content, we're going to be always looking for something else. I want to go over to Philippians chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4 and verses 9 to 13. Those things which you both learned and received and heard and seen in me, do, and the God of peace shall be with you. But I rejoice in the Lord greatly that now at the last your care of me hath flourished again, wherein you were also careful, but ye lacked opportunity. Not that I speak in respect of want, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. I know both how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere in all things I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengtheneth me. This I have learned is one word in the Greek. And the Greek here suggests that contentment, I have learned contentment. Contentment is not learned in the classroom, neither is it learned overnight. but it is learned by many practical experiences in life. And so if that is true, then we as older among the congregation here should be the most content if we really learn from the experiences of life. He's simply saying, or it gives this idea that you can't go to the classroom and learn contentment. That's not the most effective way to learn it. You're not going to learn it quick and overnight. Contentment comes with experience. Contentment is a matter of attitude. A fine old gentleman who at the age of 102 was one of the happiest people around was asked the secret of both his longevity and his personal joy. His reply was, "It's all a matter of attitude." For example, he said, "When I get up in the morning, I go over to the window and look out to see what the weather's doing. Sometimes I see rain, sometimes I see snow, sometimes I see sunshine. But regardless of the weather, I say to myself, this is exactly the kind of day I wanted." That's a little bit hard for me to do sometimes. Looking for rain these last couple of weeks and kind of hit and miss. This is sunny, hot day. This is just the day I wanted. The old gentleman had surely learned one of life's secret to happiness. His attitude was such as the Apostle Paul's. "I've learned in whatsoever state I am to be content." As we think of money, principle of contentment. Long before she became a hymn writer, blind Fanny Crosby, as a little girl of 8, wrote these lines. "Oh, what a happy soul am I, although I cannot see. I am resolved that in the world contented I will be. How many blessings I enjoy, the other people don't. To weep and sigh because I'm blind, I cannot and I won't." The fourth one, principle, is the snare of riches. And I'll just read this verse. We read it earlier here in 1 Timothy 6. Verse 9 says, "But they that will be rich, those that make it their goal to be rich, those that willfully choose to be rich, fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition." Will to be rich, will here means willing, minded, intended, or intentional. Some folks are forthright with their intentions. "I want to be a billionaire. When I was growing up, it was a millionaire. But today, $1 million don't go very far. And today it's a billion, and I guess we're hitting trillions now." People are trillionaires. Some folks are forthright with their intentions. Others court the idea and hardly recognize it themselves. And that's the most sneaky one. It's a bit difficult for us to put our finger on it, whether it's our own life or if it's someone else. The snare of riches. Hebrews 11:26 said of Moses, "Esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward." And 1 Timothy 6:17 says, "Charge them that are rich in this world that they be not high-minded nor trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who giveth us richly all things to enjoy." Uncertain riches. That caught my attention. And I looked it up, and it simply means something that'll soon be gone. Soon be gone. Don't set your heart on these things. They're going to soon be gone. Rockefeller, of course, many of us recognize that name. Supposedly, his testimony was, "I made my millions, but they have brought me no happiness." Snares of riches. I thought it was interesting. John Wesley, when he gave some real practical direction to, you know, sometimes you have a question, should I buy this or should I not? Where is this in light of riches, unnecessary, become a snare? And John Wesley had, it's kind of, how would you say, intense, what John Wesley put together. I think he has 4 points. I'm going to give them to you, but then I want to get to putting it in more practical later on. He said, calmly and seriously inquire. Number one, in expending this or buying this, I'm putting out my money for this. Ask yourself the question, am I acting according to my character? I say I'm a Christian. I say I am setting my affections on things above. Is it actually aligning with my character? Am I acting herein not as a proprietor, but as a steward of the Lord's goods? Or do I act like I own it? That's the first thing you need to ask when you're thinking of buying this extra thing. Number two, am I doing this in obedience to the word? Does it align with the scripture? In what scripture does he desire me to do so? So number two is the scriptural. Number three, he says, ask yourself, can I offer up this action, this expense, as a sacrifice to God through Jesus Christ? Okay, God, I'm going to spend my money on this. Will this bring glory and honor to you? Number four, have I reason to believe that for this very work, I shall have a reward at the resurrection of the just? In other words, I'm going to expend my money on this. Will it actually set value in the resurrection? He goes on to say, you will seldom need anything more to remove any doubt which arises in your head. But by this fourfold consideration, you will receive clear light as to the way wherein you should go. He was pretty confident. If you take these four things and you ponder them, you're going to have clarity of mind on the subject. He goes on to say, if doubt still remain, you may further examine yourself by prayer according to those heads of inquiry. Try whether you can say to the searcher of hearts, your conscience, not condemning you, Lord, thou seest I'm going to expend this sum on that food or that apparel or that furniture, and thou knowest I do this in obedience to the Lord as thou commandest, and because thou commandest it. Let this, I beseech thee, be an holy sacrifice acceptable through Jesus Christ. And give me a witness in myself that for this labor of love I shall have recompense when thou rewardest every man according to his works. Now, if your conscience bears you witness in the Holy Ghost that this prayer is well-pleasing to God, then you have no reason to doubt, but that expense is right and good, and such will never make you ashamed. I just like that. The snare of riches, that's our fourth principle. And so, when it comes to buying and spending things on more than the basic necessities, there are times to take these 4 points and to hold them up to it and say, how does this relate? But I think moving into the more practical side and moving off of this point, maybe a simpler, more effective way would be some specific definition or definitive decisions on for what or how many. And let me explain that. I think some of us go through life and we really never think our way through it. I've met many a person that have made some decisions in life And afterwards, they said, I wasn't thinking. I didn't think. I didn't see that coming. I didn't count the cost. And they found themselves caught. And I think it's good for us to beforehand, when it comes to spending our money and what we spend our money on, is to have some, make some definitive decision on how much or what. We need to be very decisive in our lifestyle choices. And I think we got to think some of these things through. So let's take this one, and you might be able to relate to this. Garage sales. Most people go to garage sales looking for a bargain and looking for something that possibly they might need. But you know how garage sales are. You get to a garage sale, and there's something cheap. And you say, well, I really didn't know it, need it, but it's cheap. And so I can't let it go, and so you buy it. And you get home, and you look where to put it. It's like, oh, maybe I didn't really need this. But to decisively think ahead, well, I need this and need this. And I'm going to go to garage sales. I'm going to look for this and this. That's a more effective way to do garage selling, so that you don't end up spending money you didn't need to spend and afterwards have things that you don't need and then you don't know what to do with them. But that's what we're talking about, decisive decisions. Okay, so you're looking through the shoe magazine. Ah, there's a shoe. That's just the shoe I want. But at that moment, you forget that you do have three or four pairs of shoes and you really don't need a pair of shoes, but it's cheap and it's just what I was looking for. And so you buy it and then you stick it there with the other four or five pair. It's really good, I think, for all of us to say, how many pairs of shoes do I need? Let's just get that one clear so that when I see someone else wearing some neat shoes, that I don't think, I got to go get them. But right away I think, well, I don't need another pair. How many shoes does a person need? We can do that with a lot of things. Decisions, decisive decisions. We can do that with vehicles. Men, how many vehicles do you need? Sometimes it's good for us to think that on ahead, because sometimes we find a good deal, or sometimes we don't think through it and we're like, oh, you're selling that vehicle. Oh, I want it, and I buy it. And after a while, I have more vehicles than I need and more than I can drive. Somehow I can find, I can only drive one at a time. Now, there's sometimes you have a business where you'll have a personal vehicle you drive and you have a business vehicle that you use for work. But I think it's good to answer beforehand, how many vehicles do I need? How many vehicles do I need to supply for my need? I think we can do that with what kind of vehicle we might buy. A decisive decision beforehand, looking at it and saying, what is the most appropriate vehicle for me to drive? I've seen plenty of young men who buy these trucks, expensive pickup trucks, that only go do like 12 miles to the gallon. They might do better than that today. And they're driving them for their personal vehicle. They're driving them to church. They're driving them to the friends gathering. They're driving them here and there. It's a gas guzzler. And really just throwing their money away. And so we need to be decisive in our decision. What kind of a vehicle will be the most practical for my need? There's businesses that definitely need vehicles that just don't do very good in fuel, but they're using it for business and the business is paying for it. How many vehicles do we need? We can ask ourselves the question. We're talking a little bit about buying vehicles. This really becomes a big deal. Buying vehicles. I think there's a lot of money that gets spent on vehicles that could be used wiser. When I go to look for a vehicle, I think we should be decisive in our decision of how much money is appropriate to spend for a vehicle. There's more things that come into that, but how much money shall I spend? You can go out there and find a two-year-old vehicle with 30,000 miles on, and because it's in more of an uppity-up model, you might end up paying $25,000 to $30,000 for this vehicle. When you can go find a vehicle with 30, 40, 50, 60,000 miles on it, it's more of a common, usable vehicle, a nice vehicle, where you can spend $15,000 and save that $10,000 just because you're not paying for all the extras or paying for the name or paying for whatever. I think these things need to be looked through. I think it's important that we think about these kind of things. There are some things that speak very loudly. One of them is our clothing. It tells us who we are. Our vehicles also tell us who we are. And when I drive into a church parking lot, a church that I haven't been at before, and the people I don't really know, I can get a whole idea of what kind of people I'm going to be preaching to just by the looks of the parking lot. I would really like that when people drive into our parking lot, that they see common people. Common people. We're talking about vehicles. I don't know if it's true yet today. It was true. I think it's still true. That's the way I do it. I like to buy a vehicle at about 50, 60, 70,000 miles if I want it for any longevity. It already has come off of the new lot, and once it's driven off the new lot, it depreciates a lot, just driving it off the lot. Someone else drives it for a little while, gets 30, 40, 50, 60,000 miles on it. That's your best deal for your money. I can remember Mo Stossfus mentioning that. And Mo Stossfus, just one thing I really loved about him, he was a businessman, probably a millionaire, maybe who knows how many millions in air, but he drove just practical, usable vehicles. He drove a Jetta diesel to save money. And I'm like, he could have been driving a Cadillac Guzzler that drank up gas just to be who he could have been. His house. I don't know that he ever built onto his house, or he might have remodeled it. I don't know, but it was just homey. I went there the last years of his life. It was the house he always lived in. I just appreciate that so much. A lot of money can be spent on car cosmetics. And you see it all the time. Decorative license plate borders, tinted plates, tinted lights, tinted windows. We buy a vehicle and we're soon changing out the wheels because we want a different design. We got to put a different exhaust system on to make it sound just the way we want it to sound. We do all kinds of things in interior decoration. You know what I think is just speaks really well of a Christian? Is he goes and he finds a modest vehicle. When I say modest, that means not a piece of junk and not something that is uppity up. And he buys it and he drives it. A lot of money can be spent on vanity, and it's not good use of the Lord's money. Recently, there was a young man who wanted to buy a vehicle, and he sent me the picture of the vehicle. Now, I'm not good at looking at a picture, deciding whether it's approved or not approved. I really did appreciate that he wanted input. And so I sent him three practical principles. I'm going to let him decide by these three principles. And here they were. Number one, buy a vehicle that's simple, practical, and serviceable. That's principle number one. Simple, practical, and serviceable. Not every vehicle you buy is so serviceable. Not every vehicle you buy is so practical. Not every vehicle you buy is simple. Number two, by a vehicle that is not eye-catching and outstanding. Buy a vehicle that's not eye-catching and outstanding. And number three, affordable. Affordable so that if you demolish this vehicle in a week, you could replace it even if you don't have full coverage on it. Vehicles and trucks are a very loud statement to our lifestyle. A very loud statement to our lifestyle. I am really jealous that we would have a church parking lot full of vehicles that are just simple and modest and practical and serviceable. Let's talk about investments. So if I have extra money, I can either give it away or I can invest it. We need to ask ourselves the question, why am I wanting to invest for later payback? Is it to make life easier? Maybe not all wrong. Because my friends are doing it? Probably not a good enough decision. Because I want to get rich or popular, hardly acceptable. For a while, there was quite a bit of discussion here about investing into properties to rent out. And I think it's just a fine thing to do. But I do get a little concerned when there's a lot of emphasis on investing our money and we talk about it and we encourage it and we get all excited about it. I think we have to be a little bit careful how much emphasis we put on investments. One of the things that I think is well known, which I wonder about, and that is that the Mennonites have bought a lot of rental units in Lebanon and other cities. And I don't know why. Sometimes I just kind of struggle a little bit with that image, and I'm not sure if it's because I also struggle with the image of when Mennonites and Amish move into a community and they all start buying up all the properties and they're well-to-do and they can spend money and the economy in that area just changes so quickly. And it kind of puts a bad light towards the people who were a part of that community, watching these people buy in. They have all the money they seems like they have. Want, and they could just pay anything for anything. And it kind of gives a bad testimony. And so I think we have to be careful with our investments. I'm just going to here give a caution about talking too much about investing money. I think it's good and okay to invest money. But I think it can so easily fuel that get rich quick idea. And that becomes a slippery slope. The next generation is listening. And at the Agape meetings, Clint Wolf gave a teaching on the concerns of how we invest our money. And one of the things he says there is that the generation that is growing up now, you teenagers that are growing up now, he said they feel left behind. And they're feeling left behind because supposedly it's harder to get ahead today than it was for us 50-year-olds to get ahead when we were young. Well, we had a little bit of back and forth on that. There were some people who argued against that it's so much easier to get ahead today than it was in the past. Well, I'm not here to try to prove one or the other. All I'm here is putting in a caution that if our young men, if that next generation is actually feeling that way, that it's harder to get ahead, mom and dad, they had it good. I got to work for what I'm getting. I'm going to have to put my whole heart into it, and I'm going to have to invest properly because I want to get ahead. And so we need to be careful. The other thing that is a bit of a concern is that of sitting at the feet of financial gurus. Sitting at the feet of financial gurus. I think we have to be careful. I think we can learn something from them, but I think we have to be so careful because a lot of these men do not have the same principles that we do. And we could easily be swept off our feet. Be careful whose feet you're sitting at and who's telling you how to spend your money and when to spend your money. I'd like to talk a little bit about antique, old tractors, old vehicles. In our world, there's way too much made of it. Way too much money spent on restoring old vehicles and old tractors. And then we take them to the tractor shows, car shows. I say worldly indeed. Old vehicles and old tractors, I think, have their place. If it is usable like any other vehicle, and definitely not for show or status symbol. There's a difference to drive it because it's usable and enjoyable, but it's so easily to cross a line of pride. So easy. I'm not sure that an older vehicle or older tractor, to have them just to pull them out of the shed for a joyride on a sunny day, is really not for the serious Christian who's really interested in laying up treasures in heaven. I like the idea, having grown up on a certain model of tractor, I like the idea of having one of those today. I don't have one. I might still get one. I would just really enjoy driving it. I would really enjoy putting it out in the field and working it on the field. That would just be so enjoyable. And you know, I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with that. But it can so easily cross a line where I got some pride in this thing and I have it for show and I drive it to make a statement. Let's be so careful. We're talking about money. I want to talk a little bit about the pyramid marketing products that I think we have to be very, very careful with. Pyramid marketing products, you start down here in the bottom rung, and then you get people under you, and the whole goal is to get up there to the top of the pyramid where you have enough of people under you that the money's just flowing in without you doing much of anything. I've seen people do that, and I just don't think it comes out right. And then we have other things like Prince's House, Tupperware. They don't have the pyramid. But one of the things I find for some people is that, so you get invited to a Tupperware party, and I know this could be touching really close home. I don't have a problem with Tupperware. I don't have a problem with Prince's House. The only thing is, I think we have to think through that one because it puts pressure on people to buy and to buy things they don't need or to try to figure out what they could buy because they feel obligated to help this person out. I'm sure that's not everyone. I'm sure there are some people probably who are looking at it and saying, well, if I have a chance, this is what I want to buy. This I can use. This I need. But it can so easily cross that line where we are forcing people or maybe obligating people to buy something or to have a party or to do something when they really don't have a need, but they're going to spend that money because it's you. We need to be careful with that. Certain amount of pressure to buy, to hold a party, and such the like. Just a couple of verses as we think of money. Proverbs 28:22, it says, he that hasteth to be rich hath an evil eye, and considereth not that poverty shall come upon him. Proverbs 23, 4 and 5, labor not to be rich, cease from thy own wisdom. Wilt thou set thine eyes upon that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away as an eagle toward heaven. Wouldn't mind touching a little bit on all the convenient stores that we have almost on any corner of our highways that we drive through. The reason they're called convenience stores is because they're very convenient. And they are very convenient at swallowing your money because they're not cheap. Now, another thing that is definitely coming on into most towns is a cafe. Somebody was just recently at a cafe and they said, oh, the stuff is so expensive. Individual drinks, coffee, snack foods, coffee houses, showing up in most towns, eating out, etc. These things, I think, can be beneficial on occasion. But really, we're working so that we might have to give to those that don't have. And so I think some of these things should be kept at a careful minimum. I think it's nice to go out to eat. We can enjoy that. Sometimes we're driving to Wisconsin, I'll stop and get something to drink. And when I'm really tired and we drive through the night, sometimes I'll actually get, and I shouldn't say it, a Mountain Dew to keep me going and keep me awake and keep me alive till I get there. And so some of those things are just okay. But I don't think it's good use of our money to depend on the convenience store for that coffee every morning, or that soft drink, or that, shall I say it, that, what do they call them, muscle drinks or energy drinks or those kind of things. I think there's where we have to take John Wesley's 4 points and hold them up. Again, I think there's a time for it. Another thing I would like to highlight is gardening. Not only does gardening save money, but it can be growing healthier. And a lot of people today are going back to gardening. They're moving that direction. A lot of the world who spends their time in researching what all is going into our foods today, they're getting tired of it. They're getting disoriented by all the stuff that's being pumped into our foods, and they're going back to gardening again. Sometimes I think the Anabaptist people are going the other way yet. We're always just what? A few years behind the world, and we're still moving more from gardening and buying our stuff. Now I realize, and I don't want to put any undue pressure on anyone, because we have busy families and it's not always very easy. But I like the families that say, well, I don't have the time to raise everything, but I'm going to raise some main crops. I'm going to raise my own potatoes. I'm going to raise my own corn or whatever it might be. I'm going to have my own beans. I'm not going to have all the broccolis and all the carrots and all of those things. It's too much work. I'm going to have some of those main things. The world today is doing the research, and they see all the chemicals, all the genetic alterations, all the growth hormones that are used in commercial production, all the additives to make it shelf-stable, to give it color and give it and flavor-enhancing properties to make it attractive and moorish. And they're saying, we don't want to go that way. There's a lot of things we could say as far as money. I would like to talk just a little bit yet about investments. I find it interesting that the plain community is one of those that often get caught in these risky loans, these high interest loans, these promises of a lot returned on what you invest. And these people get caught. And I just wonder if there's too much emphasis on making that investment, that good investment that'll have a really good return in a short time. I wonder if there's a little bit too much emphasis put on that. And we haven't getting caught.
and losing hundreds of thousands of dollars overnight because it was a risky loan that hadn't been looked into. We're gullible, we're vulnerable, we trust people, we're willing to do things on a handshake today, and people can take advantage of us, and we're getting caught. So much better would be to take something a little lower that you know has been stable for years and years. I think the plain community has discouraged getting involved in things like the stock markets and such the like, and I don't know enough about them to even have the credentials to say much about it, but there's a reason why we are Anabaptist people have primarily tried to stay away from those stock markets and other risky investments. Some of those investments turn over so quickly and so fast, and you can make money overnight so quick, but you can lose that much money overnight too. If we do have money to invest, let's not do it in allowing greed to dictate. Credit cards, you probably all know that credit cards should be paid off every month. Keep them current. There are those who don't pay them off and they get caught with high interest. I've heard it already. You know, people paying 30 and 40% interest on late fees or late on behind payments. I think we got to be very careful what we put on credit. What are we putting on credit? What are we loaning for? Let's be very, very careful with that. Probably a lot of other things we could say, but in closing, I am told that in the Gospels, an amazing 1 out of 10 verses deal directly with the subject of money or possessions, lending, saving, or something like that. And so we could spend a lot of time just looking at the parables in the Gospels, and we would learn a lot. 16 of the 38 parables, that's almost 50%, Jesus taught were concerned with how we handle our money and possessions. In closing, gain all you can without hurting you or your neighbor in body and soul, applying wisdom to how you do it and the time you give to it. Save all you can by cutting off every expense that only serves to indulge the foolish desires or to gratify the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, wasting nothing on sin or folly, on ourselves or our children. Finally, give all you can. Do not be stingy. Do not limit yourselves to a 10%. But we are to remember that everything that we have is the Lord's and to be constantly held in an open hand. Reckoning that as I give here, while on earth, to the cause of the kingdom, I will be able to turn my earthly things into heavenly treasures, for we cannot but give a cup of cold water in the name of the disciple, and the Lord has promised we will not lose our reward. So God bless you as you use that money that you have and use it in an ethical way and use it in a way that will witness that you're a child of God and you have an interest in laying up treasures over in heaven. I think it'd be appropriate, if you can, that we kneel down and have a prayer. Father, I just want to ask that your Holy Spirit would be able to give us direction and guidance and help us to know how to spend our money in a way that's ethical, in a way that is God-honoring, in a way that will bring glory and honor to your name. Set us free from the wrong use of money. And help us to to use that money in a way that will benefit with food and clothing, therewith be content. Let him that steals steal no more, but labor with his hand that which is good, that he may have to give to him that hath need. Father, I pray that we would be very practical and very intentional and be very decisive in how we use our money, that you might be glorified and honored, and that we might be blessed.